Hey everybody, welcome back to the Sisyphus 55 podcast. Today we're joined by Rachel O'Neill, who's an assistant professor at London School of Economics. She's a feminist media cultural studies scholar, and she's also the author of Seduction, Men, Masculinity, and Mediated Intimacy. But also, if you would like to further elaborate on exactly what you do and how you kind of got interested in this field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so as you said, I'm an assistant professor here in media and communications at LSE, where most of my research centers on questions of culture, subjectivity, and I'm really interested in understanding how it is that we come to be particular kinds of people in the world, how it is that we go about negotiating day-to-day practices in our lives in relation to the broader social and economic circumstances that we live in. And I approach a lot of that through questions of gender, through questions of power and inequality.
Okay, that's, yeah, very interesting. And I guess, like, on my end, I became very interested in this topic around the same time as there was a lot of that, like, manosphere kind of Andrew Tate kind of discourse going on. And there were some YouTubers that took it upon themselves to kind of dive into this era, this group of people, which was kind of like straight men or straight white men, and actually give it kind of an intersectional lens, which is kind of, at least at the time, I thought was kind of rare in terms of researching this group. And then I kind of came across masculinity studies and kind of, oh, there are people that actually analyze this specific group. And it is important because they're usually the ones that hold a great deal of power and influence. So it's kind of important to research kind of their own worldview and perspectives on in a more analytical way. And then also because I belong to that group. So it was kind of interesting to see certain insights and views because I, you know, when I growing up, you know, I probably adopted some of these worldviews at one point or another. And it was interesting to see them talked about in a very like academic objective sense. And and I do like personally, I feel like it's important to discuss kind of masculinity and its relation with sexuality and especially the seduction community, because it does kind of act as a sort of alternative educational system to a lot of kind of men or young men who don't feel very good about themselves. And it could be initially useful, but then it could be kind of harmful down the road. So that's how I came across your work. And especially your, when you're talking about kind of the fact that it be like sex is kind of a currency in these communities, and especially involving a lot of masculinity, that it's kind of traded amongst men to prove their gender expression. So I guess that's my kind of background. And yeah, I'm wondering how you came across like this field. What kind of made you specifically interested in this?
Well, I'm sorry, I'm such an academic, I'm making notes as you speak,
which I noticed that, yeah,
par for the course. I mean, I think you're making a great point, first of all, in highlighting masculinity studies. This is something that within the area of feminist scholarship, within the area of gender studies, a lot of the time gender is understood as a kind of a synonym for women and femininity. And I think it is fair to say that within gender studies as a whole, far less attention is given to men and masculinity studies. It is a kind of a sub area of the discipline, even though it ought to be far more prominent in many ways. So I think it's really important to draw attention to the fact that that there is this body of work, there is a field or a subfield that is specifically dedicated to studying questions of men, masculinity, the ways in which men's lives are shaped by these broader social and cultural forces that we're kind of alluding to now. And I also liked the way that you raised the the way in which the kind of the logics, the teachings that are elaborated in the seduction industry become available to young men in particular on a very wide plane. I think it's often understood, the seduction industry is often understood and written about, including by academics, as a subculture. And from the very beginning of my research, I really felt that that was inaccurate, precisely because a subculture that language assumes that you're talking about a reasonably small and bounded grouping of people, when actually, if you look at some of the entry points that people have, that men have to the seduction industry, these are extremely popular texts. So the way in which I made my way into this area of research was exactly the same way that many of my research subjects, the men that I interviewed and spent time with, made their way into it. And that was through the very, very popular best-selling book, The Game by Neil Strauss. And I have my signed copy is up here on my shelf somewhere with a very interesting inscription. And, you know, this was a text that, you know, published in the early mid 2000s and reached a really, really huge audience. It was a popular bestseller. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for weeks on end. It's been widely translated. It is a book that certainly in the UK context, you can go into charity shops, and just find it all the time. It's one of these books that kind of repeats, and it's part of a much broader set of literature that can be classified as kind of relationship self-help or sex and relationship self-help. And again, going back to the point about masculinity studies, the majority of that kind of advice of that sort is typically aimed at women. And so the literature, the academic literature on sex and relationship advice looks at how this literature frames, you know, questions of femininity, how you're supposed to kind of, how heterosexual women are instructed to learn how to kind of please and appease men, to anticipate their desires, to think about, you know, men's wants and fears, and, you know, kind of reckon with their subjectivity in many ways, sometimes in very stereotyped ways and limited ways. But the game was really different because it was packaging a set of quite parallel ideas to an audience of heterosexual men. So the same kind of core logic that intimacy is an area of life that is fraught with uncertainty, but that uncertainty is not inevitable. It can be overcome or controlled in some way. Mm-hmm. And it can be controlled if you learn these tactics and techniques. Now, ultimately, the kind of power imbalances that these different literatures generate, you know, if you're giving heterosexual women advice versus giving heterosexual men advice, there's often a kind of a power imbalance that is replayed in those literatures, as women are taught how to kind of make themselves more kind of appeasing and amenable, whereas men are often taught to be kind of more assertive and bolder. And so this literature often kind of reinscribes those power dynamics. But anyway, suffice to say, it was The Game that initially drew my attention to the seduction industry. I came across that book in a charity shop. I was at the time just beginning a master's program in gender. I was already very aware that a lot of gender studies is focused on women and femininity. I was very interested in questions of men and masculinity, perhaps just a little bit by nature being a little bit, you know, wanting to look at the less obvious topic maybe in the field. And when I came across the book and I read it, I was interested to know, to what extent does the community and the industry that Strauss describes in the book actually exist in the wider world? I was living in London at the time, and I just started looking, you know, are there seduction related events happening in the city? And it was very simple to find them. There were many events taking place at the time. I started the kind of very first round of research that I did for this project would have been around 2008, 2009. And the very first event I went to was in a central London hotel with over 100 men present who were listening to tips and advice that were being delivered by a trainer with a reasonably prominent UK-based company. And the question that really exercised me at the time and that motivated the project as a whole was to try and understand what makes participation in these spaces, engagement with these texts, compelling. Why do men read these books? Books like The Game, but the many, many other books like it that have since been published. What makes men want to engage with the kind of YouTube tutorials and videos and infield content that you can find on YouTube and on other platforms? What makes men want to actually pay to attend these courses and to connect with men who style themselves as pickup artists and seduction trainers? What makes men actually want to go along and participate in those events? And then what happens to them when they get there? So that's kind of how I got to it. And the question really that's been motivating it, why is this compelling? And again, at this particular historical moment, because I think the historical moment is really, really crucial in actually answering that in a kind of fully formed way.
That is a very compelling question to ask. I kind of wonder, when it's kind of stripped of everything else, for me, at least, I think what compels men to go to these spaces is in terms of like, they feel like they are inadequate in some way in terms of expressing their gender identity, which they are, they want to feel masculine. And at least for me, I feel like it's very culturally endorsed that, sexual domination or sexual success, or as you use in the book quite often, in a, somewhat crude language, but I think appropriate here, is access to women's bodies, is kind of the social signal of, being sexually successful. And then because of that, being more masculine, more manly, like you're hitting that checklist. So I'm kind of curious, with your own research in these spaces, before getting into the specifics, maybe, what do you think is the relationship between masculinity and sexuality and sexual desire, like in general, but mm-hmm. also more specifically talking in terms of like the kind of white Western, like European culture?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, it's perfect that you ended on that note, because I was just about to say, when we're asking such a big question about, the relationship between men and sex or male sexuality, the question then has to become which men, where, when. So my research has specifically been located in the UK context. All of my research was undertaken in London. I was within that speaking to men from a broad range of different backgrounds, some of whom were from the UK, some of whom were maybe second generation immigrants, some of whom were not from the UK, but were visiting in some way or had come to the UK recently to live. So it is very much speaking to and from the context of the West or the global North. Although, again, recognizing that I think a lot of the texts that circulate in the seduction industry travel much further than that context, though you can easily find pickup artist materials in the Indian context, for example. Mm-hmm. So, yes, focusing in first on the question of which men where, and I'm also very focused clearly on heterosexual men. So this is the seduction industry is specifically speaking to and offering advice for heterosexual men. There isn't really space within this industry, within the kind of discourses that it makes available, to think about sexuality in any other way. So there's not a kind of option to be gay or to be bi, for example, in these spaces. Those kinds of orientations just aren't present. They're there purely by absence, or were invoked by men in very kind of conventional ways, through jokes, for example, mm-hmm. That's so gay, that kind of thing, which is clearly about kind of delegitimating those options or those orientations. So yes, so men who are heterosexual are the grouping that I'm speaking about. And as you're saying yourself, based on your own observations, there is a sense for men, and we also know this from academic research, not just my own, but many other studies besides, that men are often taught to understand sex and that crude phrase, sexual access to women's bodies, as the thing that confers masculinity or as a necessary prerequisite to the confirmation of masculinity by other men. That's often quite crucial. Mm-hmm. It's not simply that by being able to access women's bodies, you can confirm your masculinity. It's by having that access observed in some way by other men and being seen to be legitimately masculine by other men. But sexual access to women's bodies is crucial to that. And that's part of a broader formulation about the kind of the control of women, or what has been called in some researches the kind of traffic in women that is crucial to patriarchal networks. Mm-hmm. So yes, the phrase is somewhat crude, but it is absolutely deliberate. Mm-hmm. And I think some of the research that most shocked me or kind of stayed with me is research demonstrating that when it comes to the pursuit of sexual access to women's bodies, the pursuit of sex, sometimes, and especially in research with young men and boys even, boys will recount to researchers that they find themselves in scenarios where they are pursuing sexual interactions with other girls or with women, even when they don't really want to, because they know that this is the thing that boys are supposed to do. And some of the most kind of poignant scenarios are those in which boys recount to researchers how they pushed girls into sex or pushed them into sexual encounters that they knew the girl didn't really want and that they themselves didn't really want, but that they thought was in some way expected of them. And the expectation, when you delve further into their stories and ask, where's that expectation coming from? It's coming from society in a broad sense, but it's kind of enforced by other boys and men around them. And so this is the kind of, I mean, it's been talked about by academic researchers as the kind of the triangle scenario. And you see this in films and television all the time, where there's a woman and two men in a given narrative, in a given story. And the woman is the kind of the pivot through which the relationship between men is actually being actualized. And she is not actually as central to the storyline as she might appear. I mean, you've kind of classic examples of this in any of the Batman films, for example. There's always a woman present, but the real relationship is between the hero and the villain. And
Yeah,
in a
Christopher Nolan's quite good at that. Not writing a very fully fleshed out female character.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. And so yeah, so those were the kinds of that's some of the background, I suppose, to academic research on in the area of masculinities and sexualities that has also kind of motivated the research. And it also, I think part of the reason that research really stays with me is that I found very similar dynamics, even though I was working with adult men. These were men who were all over 18, and many of them were in their 20s and 30s. There was a similar kind of dynamic at play where sometimes they didn't even necessarily know what it is that they wanted themselves from dating and intimacy, but there was an expectation coming from somewhere, and sometimes quite clearly coming from their friendship circle, that they should be going out and pursuing women, and they should, in particular, be pursuing casual encounters, even if that wasn't really what they themselves wanted or were interested in, or what was actually happening for them. Maybe they had already met somebody and they wanted a kind of more intimate or long-term relationship. And something that I found within the seduction industry was that that logic was intensified manyfold, because trainers would expressly tell students, so men who've paid to take courses with them, women are for practice. You should be approaching women, you should be going out on dates, you should be sleeping women as a way to get your skill base up. And the actual encounter doesn't really matter that much. What actually happens doesn't really matter that much. The important thing is that you're kind of working that muscle and you're building up that muscle. And some of them made a very kind of clear comparison, where you invoked the metaphor of the gym, where you have to keep working the muscles, otherwise they will kind of fall away. You have to keep invoking those skills and practicing and honing those skills, otherwise they will deteriorate. And in that regard, something I found really, again, kind of striking and poignant were instances where men would tell me, and this came from including men who were very deep in the industry themselves, who were trainers, that they had to keep going out and sleeping with women. They didn't want to. They were tired. They'd been doing it all week. They'd already slept with three or four women. They couldn't remember any of their names. They were, it was all a kind of a blur. It was a haze. But they had to keep doing it because the skill base of being able to approach women, to talk with them, to maneuver the encounter into the bedroom, that skill base had been so hard won that they were terrified of losing it. And what this gave rise to was this kind of perpetual discontent, and this kind of this fixation on pursuing sexual encounters, even when they didn't want to. They didn't necessarily even want to be doing this. but there's this fear of losing the skill. So that same kind of basic logic that we've talked about sex as something that men are, heterosexual men are told is important for them to pursue and attain because it's a mark of their masculinity, that logic becomes intensified in the seduction industry and led to some very unhappy outcomes.
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting, I think, point to really hammer home, is that even men that, and I think Neil Strauss is one of them, that they did find a lot of success in terms of fulfilling this one particular aspect of masculinity. Later on, they would go on to kind of say that this actually made me quite depressed and kind of led to a lot of issues in terms of intimacy. That, you know, maybe this isn't what people should be warned. Young men should be warned earlier on that this particular path isn't necessarily like going to lead to happiness, especially if you're somewhat emotionally sensitive and you crave some sort of affection. It can actually like callous your heart in some ways. And I guess from that, there is this part of the process that I see reflected in the book is this idea that it's about the quantity of sex and not the quality of sex that the advice is giving. Like if these people were really talking about, you know, there's a form of seduction that's very romantic and, you know, such as like foreplay, it's like, you know, it could enhance the experience of intimacy. But there was sort of this feeling of it was like a conveyor belt. It was like an industrial sort of process of just keep going and going and going. And at the same time, you're dehumanizing this other group of people, women. And I think that's the thing that has really hit home for me, especially in your work. And I would love for you to like elaborate on it, is this idea that the seduction community and maybe just modern perspectives of sexuality from men in general reflect a sort of neoliberal or kind of Fordist model of intimacy, of sex. And it kind of, you know, I think it's a really, it specifically is able to criticize this form of human relationships without turning into a fully like socially conservative, like kind of a puritanical antagonism towards sex in general. It still nonetheless kind of explains why these men can succeed in some terms, but then feel very depressed with regards to the outcome. So I'd love for you to elaborate specifically on that.
Absolutely. Yeah. So within the seduction industry, even though, I mean, for as long as I've been researching it, everyone will tell you that we've moved away from the canned content that Neil Strauss elaborated and that was associated to the kind of early era of pickup. We don't do that anymore. And to an extent, that's true. It's not entirely scripted, but there are very clearly laid out formulas that are supplied by trainers and that the men who study with them, who take their courses or who watch their videos online and so forth are encouraged to adopt. And there is quite a bit of scripting that goes into that. It's just not as kind of hammy as the earlier versions that Neil Strauss could have made famous or popularized. And we see examples of this with actual blueprints, like literal blueprints, as you'd see in architecture, that lay out the different stages of intimacy. And you kind of actually hit on this earlier when you mentioned foreplay. This is something that exists more widely in society and culture. We have an idea that intimate encounters, sexual encounters, play out in relation to a kind of a script or a kind of a formula. There are certain stages to it. And and foreplay, you know, was obviously a step before the kind of main event and so forth. So that logic exists culturally. And what the seduction industry does is it codifies that in really clear ways. So you will find documents, you'll find guides, you'll find textbooks, you'll find online videos that set out the different stages. And it might be that there are four stages to an encounter or there are 10. And within that, it not only tells men, you know, these are the stages of an interaction, and there's a kind of linear progression from meeting through to kind of cultivating rapport and intimacy through to ultimately sex. That's where it goes. And that's usually also the end of it. It often doesn't go far beyond that to, well, what happens if you would want to meet that person again, for example. And so that kind of logic exists culturally. The seduction industry codifies it, but more than that, it provides very specific tactics, techniques to be exercised through each of those stages. So if one of the stages is building rapport, the trainers that I observed, so when I went to the sessions and I watched them giving advice to men, they would give very specific examples of the kinds of things that you might say to try and build rapport in a very strategic and instrumental way, but nevertheless in a way that's supposed to feel very, very intensely intimate to the other party. So there's something really important to think about here in relation to this kind of neoliberal structuring and restructuring of desire and intimacy. And I like the cultural studies scholar Eva Luz uses the language of cold intimacy. And I think it's a really useful framework to draw on to explain what's happening in the seduction industry, because it's not that the kind of encounters that are being modeled here and that men are encouraged to engage for themselves are devoid of emotion. They're not. They're highly emotional. They're about trying to get the maximum emotional response from a woman very, very quickly and to make her feel very closely connected and intimately engaged with you in a very short period of time. And there's something that's so interesting and so troubling about that. As I said, because it's not that it's this cold and clinical approach to sex and romance. In some ways it is, but in it's the harnessing of emotionality and emotional intensity towards this predetermined outcome, this kind of linear script that you're going to follow, you're ultimately going to or going to try to get to sex. And so you have this kind of this cold intimacy. And I think in terms of the neoliberal logic that we see here, it's very basically one of accumulation. So you want to accumulate sexual experience, you want to accumulate sexual skill in order to accumulate a kind of sexual capital, which is for men also a kind of masculine capital that works in a very different way for women. A certain kind of sexual capital for women functions very, very differently. Being desirable is one thing, but being sexually experienced does not tend to function as kind of positive social capital for women in the way that it does for men. And this logic of accumulation and the idea of sex and intimacy is something to be worked at. And that follows a much broader neoliberal reframing of every aspect of life as something to be worked on. You don't simply work on your actual work and your job, although you should definitely always be hustling. But you have to work at everything else just as hard. You have to work on your body. You have to work on your sense of fashion and how you kind of style yourself. You have to work on your personality. Are you really kind of well-rounded? Have you got enough interests? You have to work on your education. You have to work on every aspect of the self, because every area of your life is subject to this logic of accumulation, of capital accumulation. You need to maximize your human capital to be the best possible version of yourself in order to maximize your opportunities within the world. And why that's so closely connected to broader kind of economic circumstances is because there's a sense of precarity and a sense of uncertainty that really undergirds and pushes forth that work ethic, that logic that you have to really work hard on yourself in every area of life, because there's no safety net. And because your life is probably, certainly for young middle class people, your life is probably not going to turn out quite the way that your parents did in terms of the opportunities that are available to you and the kinds of security that you're likely to be able to attain through your job and so forth. So there's this kind of generalized sense of precarity that makes that work ethic and the idea that's accurate. The idea that you really can work on intimacy and intimate relationships, and that is a way in which you can achieve control. You can actually, there's something so interesting about that. Rather than recognizing or thinking about intimacy as something, as a kind of a zone of vulnerability in one way or another, in multiple ways, because we can't control other people. We can't control how other people might feel about us. And then intimacy might be something that unfolds more or less spontaneously or doesn't. But with this kind of neoliberal conversion and this entry of neoliberal logics, the logics of the market, the logic of work into the intimate domain, those kinds of ideas are pushed aside and even outright denied. So, no, you can achieve control in this area. And at the end of the day, one of the reasons why I really use the language of seduction industry or community industry is because it's often just referenced as the seduction community. And there is a strong community aspect to it, but this is ultimately a commercial venture for the people who make a living from doing this, who write the books, who host the blogs, who produce the video content, who sell the courses, who run the weekend programs, and so forth. And the commercial dimension, I think, is again really important to highlight and to underline as well.
Do you have sort of the numbers for how much this industry, like just off the top of your head, around how much it generates, like per year?
I wouldn't have any kind of anything that would be accurate currently. I mean, the last time I was looking into the figures was some time ago. To give a sense, rather than maybe talking about the industry at large, which I think it would be fair to say is definitely in the multi millions per year in terms of if you're thinking about all the different types of content that's being produced, again, the books, many of which are going to be sold on people's own websites on a self-published basis, but also access to the programs in terms of online content and materials, all sorts of offshoots in terms of, seduction and pickup have provided the basis for reality TV shows. There have been films made that are tied to this or utilize the industry as its basis or personalities associated to the industry as the basis for the story. So again, because it's so dispersed, because it's not a subculture, I think it's difficult to get a handle on that. But in terms of the monies that individuals might spend, the cost of a lot of the weekend programs that I was looking at was in the thousands. So you could get some programs that might be in the kind of 800, 900 pound mark, but there were courses that were far more expensive than that. And then the week-long courses where you're actually living with trainers, those would definitely be in the thousands. So 3 to 5,000 would be a kind of common figure. And those figures are going back a few years from when I was more kind of actively researching it. But that kind of cost, and again, thinking about that neoliberal logic and that kind of entry of market rationalities into the intimate sphere, I had some interesting moments in interviews where I would ask men, so why have you signed up to take this course? So we met on a weekend training program. You had just spent the guts of, £1,000 or maybe £2,000 to be there. Why did you decide to pay for that? Why did you decide to make that investment, as it were? And men spoke about it as an investment and one that they felt was likely to pay off and to offer a better return on investment or ROI than anything else they might do towards the goal of sexual success. So one man literally pulled out his phone and showed me the figures he had done. He was like, I could spend this much money on going to the gym and, having a really cool look and, having great clothes and stuff, or I could spend money on, buying this man's program, so getting his online content, but also coming to his event, traveling to London to be here, spending money on a hotel, spending money in the clubs to go out with them. And the way he talked about it was that it was a better return on investment. This was more likely to give him the kind of results that he wanted. And so again, there's that very clear kind of market mentality and the idea that if you just make the investment, if you put in the work, you will be able to get the kind of rewards that are being promised by these individual trainers, but also that is the kind of that is the cultural logic of neoliberalism more generally, which is all kind of tied up in many ways to the idea of the American dream, right? Like that's the American dream is a kind of a shorthand, a cultural shorthand for that script of, really work hard, really invest, and you'll make it despite everything being against you, or despite many, many hurdles being in your way.
Oh, that's a very interesting because I recently also just had on the podcast he was an anthropologist who studies human like dating relationships, and I mean, his take is most things we do in life are in terms of, at least at the anthropological level, for reproduction or mating, which I think in some sense that makes sense. Like we do probably do quite a bit in order to, or at least I think especially men, in order to find some sort of affection or some sort of like a intimacy with somebody at a very like base level, whatever that turns into. But this is almost, you know, it's almost exaggerated the extent to which people will go to have control over that, because the thing is like we don't really have control over like who exactly is attracted to us at the end of the day, which is just a scary thing to maybe accept for a lot of people. You can really like somebody, they just don't like you back. Doesn't matter how much you like work on yourself or anything like that. And it's like, in a way, it makes sense in my head why they would invest so much money into that, because that just the idea or hope of the guarantee that you can attract whoever you want to attract is such a, you know, it speaks to that almost like I think primal feeling of this is something that you want, but it's kind of out of your control at the end of the day. There's a little bit of contradiction. And I guess going from that, I'm kind of wondering, you know, there's this contradiction in the seduction industry of women are kind of the holders of the value of men. They're kind of like they are what give validation or worth to men is the access to women. And at the same time, there is a sort of misogynistic, sometimes very misogynistic and objectifying and dehumanizing view of women. And it causes this weird sort of like parasitic, like how do you basically, it's like the fox in the hen house. How do you get in, grab what you need and get out without getting like, you know, tied down or without getting, you know, any sort of emotional consequences of having to be vulnerable, basically, because then that is where you can maybe lose control in some sense. I'm kind of wondering, and also if, because I just said a lot, if you want to elaborate on anything else, but also just for you specifically, what was it like being a woman interacting with these men that would like hold these views that would kind of at the end of the day also, you know, regrettably, they would also maybe see you as like something that could give them self-worth, or like I'm sure that they were probably using you to practice their techniques at times. But I'm curious about that.
I mean, it's actually the question that I get asked most often about the book. And actually, when I was putting the book together, I decided to put the chapter on field work. So my reflections of being in the field, of doing interviews, of going to events and so forth. I decided to put that at the back of the book because I wanted to draw some kind of distance between myself and the project or those experiences and the kind of intellectual argument that I'm making. I think it's there are many different aspects to it, but I think women are often called upon to certainly in it's kind of an expectation in feminist research that you will do that work of reflexivity and you will talk about those experiences. And it's something that you find especially heavily is this an especially high expectation or assumed expectation when the context is of one that has any kind of sexual theme. So there can be a kind of a prurience to that. So there's research, for example, scholars who do work around bodies and body work. And one scholar in particular who did work research with nurses and then did research with sex workers. And when asked about the research with nurses, nobody ever asks, well, did you become a nurse yourself? Did you take up a caring role in a hospital? Whereas when she talks about her research on sex work, she's always asked, well, so did you do it? Did you position yourself in this way? Did you go native and so forth? So it's this kind of, I had this difficulty in thinking about how to talk about my experiences of doing the research because it is a kind of expectation and a kind of for very good reason in feminist research that you will have that kind of reflexivity and do that work of thinking about how you as the kind of the tool of research, the instrument of research, shape the process and shape the findings. But then also feeling that I didn't want to necessarily always have to lead with that because it was something that I was asked so often about. So I do kind of bracket it that way in the book, but I mean, this was a project. I've researched the, I mean, I was researching the seduction industry in some way for almost a decade, and I had a very sustained period of around 14, 15 months of field work where I was meeting men on a near daily or weekly basis to do interviews, to go to events. I was consuming seduction content continually, you know, reading books, reading blog posts, following threads and conversations, comments, forums. And so it was something that I lived and breathed for over a year. And it's very difficult to kind of summarize that experience in, you know, in a few, not that I'm summarizing anything here in a few words, but it's not easy to kind of briefly describe it because it was such a strong, it was a very kind of profound experience. But there was also a kind of long durée to it. It was so sustained. And I had some really incredible learning moments, and I had some really incredible conversations with men. There's often an idea in men's studies, which is a particular approach to men and masculinity studies. Men's studies is, well, they have slightly different political affiliations and orientations. But anyway, suffice to say, in men's studies, there's an often idea that it takes one to know one. And only a man can really research men because women just don't really get it. And I had that put to me on a radio program I did once where a caller called in and was like, how could you understand anything about men as a woman? I think we need to really challenge that idea of fundamental sexual difference. And I also think that there are things that as a woman doing this research, I was able to learn and gain access to in a man in a way that men probably wouldn't or wouldn't in the same way. And there are many different dimensions to that, even just accessing the industry at all. As a woman, I'm very conspicuous. I was always, you know, on view. I was always being asked, what are you doing here? I never blended in. I was never in the background. So I had so many opportunities to start conversations because I was never just blending into the background as a male researcher might have done, and as loads of male journalists have done over the years in their various exposés of the industry. So I had lots of conversations, and I was able to kind of open conversations very easily because men I met were very curious about my presence. But in terms of the interviews I did themselves, many of my interviews went for several hours. They were very, very long. I would talk to men for 4 and 5 hours at a time. I would talk with them on multiple occasions. And on several occasions in interviews, I had men say, I've never told that to anyone before. Or to end the interview by saying, you know more about me than anyone in my whole life. I've never been able to have these conversations with any of my friends. I would never be able to tell this to anyone. I tell these fears, these anxieties to anyone because there's no space. There's no space available to do so. That is not something that I feel allowed to do as a man. And so something about being a woman in those spaces and being a not just a woman, but being a woman researcher who's asking questions and who's, you know, being quite both kind of neutral but also empathetic. You know, I am really listening to what men have to say. I'm asking questions. I am not making judgments upon them. And so it opened a space for really interesting intimacies and, you know, kind of one-sided intimacies, insofar as I wasn't kind of relating back to them in the same way. But so I had some really profound conversations, and I gained insight into some of the vulnerabilities that men walk around with that are absolutely intersectional. These are insecurities and vulnerabilities that are not only about gender, they can and are, but they're also about race. Race was a huge point of discussion. Racial dynamics, racial difference, racial discrimination, racism was something that was patterned through my data, through my interviews with men. And class was something that came up as well. You know, some of the reasons as to what motivates men's engagement in the seduction industry, you know, it's about making up for perceived deficits elsewhere. I feel that I'm at a deficit because I'm a brown man. I feel that I'm at a deficit because I don't have money and I don't have education. But if I could be good with women, if I could be really good with women, then that would be something. That would be a mark of my success in some way, and success in a way that is very socially valued and that men are aware is very socially valued, particularly among other men, but also more generally. Men had, I remember one occasion, one man who was a South Asian man, and he was so hurt by the fact that in all of his years living in the UK and many of his friends being white British men, they'd never set him up on a blind date with any of their female friends. And it was just so crushingly painful to him that he was set aside in that way and not considered worthy or desirable enough by his male peers and friends. And so those conversations were really, really profound. And also, there's an interesting thing in research that I don't think people talk a lot about, which is the intimacy that you developed with your transcripts. So every interview that I did, I typed up in full. That takes hours and hours and hours and hours. And then you read it again and again and again, and you're comparing it to other transcripts, and you're going back through different questions. How do different people respond to different questions? And by the end of it, you know the transcripts off by heart, and they're each of them can be 50 pages or 100 pages. And I think that's really interesting. So that's a very kind of partial answer to some of the dynamics in my field work. There were also far less kind of positive aspects as well, where I did feel that I was being that I was being manipulated, that I was being utilized, or there were kind of attempts to instrumentalize me in some way as a researcher to try and trainers in particular trying to maneuver our interactions in such a way that I would put out a kind of a positive story about the industry, essentially, or trainers who wanted to shock me and put me in situations that they knew would be would have a kind of sense of risk or a sense of threat to a woman alone in a room of 15 men, for example, watching certain kinds of videos and content. And I think sometimes there was a kind of a power dynamic or a power play to see, okay, she's come into this space, she thinks she can do this work, but what can she handle? And so there are all sorts of these dynamics. And then there were other dynamics that were also kind of difficult because, and something that we've only kind of glanced on, but some of the men who become involved in the seduction industry, who seek out the forms of education that are being provided here. And it is, you use that word early on, education, and it is expressly pedagogical, and it is supposed to be helping men. And that is the promises of help. And what that language lends itself to, and that ethos lends itself to, is the entry of significant numbers of men who have quite significant mental health problems, who wouldn't necessarily seek out mainstream therapy, wouldn't necessarily have access to or even know where to go for other kinds of therapy or support, or just wouldn't feel that those are legitimate or acceptable sources of support or help. They make their way into the industry, and there were numerous examples of in my field work where men were very clearly in acute distress. They needed professional help. And I had one example of a trainer who was himself had some clinical experience, some kind of psychology background, and he knew that, and he recognized it, and he knew his company was exploiting those men. But that was the price to be paid. So I had some encounters with men who I felt were very very on edge and potentially dangerous, and I occasionally became the outlet for some of that.
Right. That's quite a, I mean, I guess that speaks also to the intersectionality of this group too, is that there's also levels of like mental health, and then when you add in like a lower socioeconomic status, they don't have access to the resources to treat that. And it does tie to the larger discussion of how much of people of men seeking out this advice or seeking out this community comes from maybe larger material inequalities. I am curious specifically because, I have white friends, then I also have like POC friends. And naturally, when you're talking amongst guys, you do end up talking about dating and like little things like, oh, what should I text this person? Or like, this person hasn't responded. And it's just like little things like that. And I do notice every once in a while with my non-white friends that there is a epistemic rift in terms of like, you know, I don't know what it's like in terms of dating, especially I'm in Canada, it's predominantly white here. As somebody who isn't white, that there is, you know, learning from them, there is a difference in terms of experience and treatment with how, especially on dating apps, how people will treat you or how dating kind of works here. So I'm very curious if you could elaborate on maybe sort of the general experiences. I know you kind of mentioned it, but the general experiences you see, and also from what I noticed in the book, the sort of internalized rationalizations and logic that some of these minority men would kind of bring up when trying to justify why they should still follow this advice, even if it didn't really align with like who they were and was sometimes directly prejudiced against who they were.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think so there are a range of ways that race played out in my research. And I think some of it is in relation to the kind of the homosocial formation of the industry itself. So certainly on the weekend programs and the in-person training, there's an idea that the trainers are going to they're absolutely teaching, and that's very clear. There's a very kind of clear pedagogical remit. But the trainers try and position themselves and style themselves kind of as men's friends. You know, we're all just a group of guys. We're going out. It's going to be an awesome night. You know, there's a kind of covering over of the commercial dynamic to try and, you know, make it one of friendship between men and men supporting one another, which is also a very it's a rhetoric that you see in different facets of the manosphere more broadly that I think can be really, really compelling to a lot of men who feel that, you know, brotherhood is a kind of a social right that they've somehow missed out on, or that maybe doesn't exist in the way that they wanted it to. And this was something that for South Asian men, so British South Asian men, so British Indian, British Pakistani, they might some of them had been born here, some of them were immigrants, you know, first and second generation. So a range of different kind of positionings. But many of the South Asian British men I spoke to, and they were kind of overrepresented within my research cohort in terms of the interviews that I did, but also in the industry in London specifically, more widely, it's kind of noted and recognized. You know, a lot of people in the industry would say, yeah, we have a kind of disproportionate number of brown men coming. For these kinds of, you know, coming to our events and so forth. So that's something, you know, the fact that it's disproportionate in my research is kind of mirroring what I was seeing in the industry and what people told me about the industry here in London. And men from those backgrounds that I spoke to talked about the fact that they felt there were things about dating culture in the UK that they just didn't really get or understand. And that they thought this was going to be kind of a way for them to have it actually laid out quite expressly, like this is what you should do, these are the expectations, this is what women want, and so forth. And so it was a way of kind of gaining access to that kind of cultural knowledge that is shaped by race and ethnicity. There was also an idea of wanting to have access to a certain kind of male friendship and to be accepted by the male trainers who are seen as whatever other characteristics they might have. They're successful men because they're good with women. And so it was a kind of access to that kind of network of men. And one of the things that I think is interesting and really problematic in the seduction industry is that a lot of the most high-profile trainers are white. The most successful trainers that I met and interviewed and observed were white men in the UK. And a lot of their students are, as I said, there's a disproportionate number of South Asian men. And so there's something that's quite difficult and problematic about that kind of relationship where essentially white men are held up and position themselves as the kind of arbiters of knowledge and of masculinity. You know, this is how to be a man. And some of the models that they prescribe for men don't actually work out very well for other kinds of men and other kinds of male bodies that are marked differently by race. And this was something that I found in particular with Black men that I interviewed. And Black men, by contrast to South Asian men in the seduction industry in London, are fewer than you would expect given the population of the UK. So they are conspicuous in their absence from the seduction industry. There aren't very many. Which is also interesting in terms of how white trainers will kind of borrow the stylistics of Black masculinity, you know, in and the language and so forth in talking about what are what a kind of ideal man looks like and sounds like. But when white trainers would give Black men certain kinds of activities and tasks to do at training sessions, they didn't account for that racial difference. So I had examples of Black men who were told to, as were all the other attendees, you know, start approaching women on Oxford Street, one of the busiest shopping streets in the country. And for, you know, for Black men, if they approached a woman on Oxford Street and they maybe they're moving quickly through the crowd, or they're, you know, they've made eye contact with the woman sees them coming at them, they had several instances where women kind of clutched their bags and moved away because they feared these men. And so this was an example of a kind of a very presumptive viewpoint of the white trainer not recognizing how that embodied difference will make a difference actually on the ground and not accounting for that. And also offering advice to Black men that that was very much about conforming again to a certain kind of model of masculinity. So, you know, I had one Black man I interviewed who said that he had in his overhaul, his kind of overhaul of his wardrobe and so forth through his engagement with the seduction industry, he was only wearing suits from now on as a kind of effort to become respectable and to look like a certain kind of respectable man. And so those kinds of dynamics, yeah, the advice that's being given doesn't account for racial difference. And you know, there's something that's very difficult and unfair about that, considering, you know, the kind of audience for a lot of this. Another way that race plays out is in structures of desire. And there are at least two different ways of talking about this, or two different dimensions to mention. So one is men of color, and particularly South Asian men I spoke to, feeling like they were considered by women and kind of in a sexual marketplace as less valuable than white men. And so there's this very common narrative among many men I spoke to of different racial positionings that Black men are kind of the most masculine and the most kind of good with women in a way that is not actually, that's maybe sounds like it's a compliment, but it's a very, there's a very insidious logic to that kind of argument, that Black men are kind of naturally good with women and so forth. But Black men are kind of the most masculine, and then white men who can kind of pick up these skills and cultivate themselves as having this masculine capital. But brown men are kind of kept out of that. And denied access to it. And that maps on to much broader logics about kind of effeminacy among South Asian men, which is a very kind of long-standing colonial discourse. And so there's this kind of racialized hierarchy among men, which is very problematic in the context of an industry that's promising you brotherhood and fraternity. And so the trainers had to kind of cover over those dynamics in various ways, while at the same time, sometimes behind students' backs being, you know, very derogatory towards their students of color. But another way that this all plays out, and in a way that's, you know, quite difficult and uncomfortable, was a vaunting of white women and white women as the ultimate object of men's interests and efforts. And that was the case among many of men of color I spoke to, was that they didn't want to be with women of their own racial grouping or of other racial groupings. They wanted to pursue white women specifically. And they felt that that was the real marker of kind of masculinity And that would be the marker of their kind of true kind of integration or their acceptance within British society if they were migrants or they were first or second generation. And so there's a very, these dynamics of sexual racism played out both ways, actually. And it was interesting to have these conversations where, for example, a South Asian British man is telling me that he feels he's being sexually discriminated against, that he's accorded lesser sexual value in British society, but then to simultaneously turn around and tell me that he only wants to sleep with white women. Mm-hmm. And so there was a kind of a lack of reflexivity around those kinds of issues. So feeling persecuted by sexual racism, but also evincing exactly that same logic in reverse. So yeah, long-winded way of saying there are a whole different spectrum of ways that race played out and made itself present in this research.
No, I mean, I think that's extremely constructive to go over, because I feel like that, you know, as you said, these communities are seen as subcultures, but I think that there's almost like there's a subculture, especially when it comes to how certain racial minorities deal with dating, that isn't really addressed by this just kind of white heteronormative, industry. And I think that it's important to be more outspoken about that, because I feel like it leads to a lot of just internalization and kind of pushing things aside in order to conform. On kind of on that note, and kind of like a final question, I do wonder, just after all of the experience, because at the end of the day, there are just well-meaning men who feel inadequate when it comes to dating. If you had to write your own sort of the game, which I would assume would be a little bit more humanizing and considerate and well backed up, if you have any sort of advice in general towards men that do feel insecure mm-hmm. when it comes to their success, and I guess, with women, but also expanding to other orientations.
It's a great question. It's a big question. Yeah, there are a few things that I'd say, actually. So one would be recognizing that your uncertainty is not a unique experience. It is shared, and it is shared by anyone who goes out into the world and encounters other people and has hopes and dreams and investments in what might happen with those encounters, those moments. And so uncertainty and the anxiety that generates, that's a feature of intimacy, and it doesn't have to be a bad thing, especially if you recognize that it's not unique to you. Other people experience that. Other men and women experience that. The person that you are interacting with in the moment might be experiencing that. And so being able to kind of sit with that uncertainty and be accepting of it to an extent, I think is important or can be valuable. I also think that this is a phrase I end up using a lot in many different contexts, but sometimes the best way to get somewhere and the fastest way to get there is not in a straight line. It's not taking, the A to B. Maybe it's taking a more circuitous route. It's going the long way around. And by that, I mean that I think in order to have the kind of interactions or relationships that you might want, and, I think this applies whether or not you're particularly interested in more casual encounters or you're more particularly interested in finding a relationship, being less concerted in the search and the pursuit, I think will often lead you to have more interesting encounters and relationships and more enjoyment along the way. So being less direct, less concerted, less focused about, this is my goal and I'm going to pursue my goal in this kind of head down kind of way, but actually kind of standing back, looking up, and being open to a much broader array of experiences that you can't control and you can't anticipate in advance and you can't direct and choreograph and maneuver and manipulate, mm-hmm. but being open to a broader range of encounters and experiences and thinking about them as experiences rather than this kind of logic of accumulation that I think sets in not just in industries like the seduction industry, but again, that's a cultural logic that exists much more widely. I heard this on the radio the other day, talk about body count, which is a new language on TikTok. And I thought, first of all, body count, I mean, it's supposed to, you know, what's your body count as in how many sexual partners have you had? But body count, I mean, that actually sounds like you're talking about how many people have you killed. But anyway,
there was a former friend I had that would use the term kill count, which was just kind of I guess more directly to the point, but mm-hmm, I always thought mm-hmm. that was a little weird.
But again, that's the logic of accumulation, mm-hmm. and that is not the same thing as experience. And if you're really focused on accumulation, you're probably missing out on a lot of the experience or the potential experience that you might actually have. Mm-hmm. So I think being less goal oriented, and even if you do have certain kinds of hopes or ambitions for yourself sexually and intimacy, being a little bit less concerted about pursuing them and being open to pursuing other interests that you might have, and hopefully finding and making connections along the way, mm-hmm. rather than, you know, kind of dating or pursuing dating or pursuing sex in this very kind of linear and single-minded way. And then finally, I think, and this might be the kind of most important thing I would say, is that relationships of all sorts are based on and thrive through subject to subject relationality, subject to subject engagement. And by that I mean really and truly engaging with the person who's actually in front of you, the person that you're actually with or that you'd like to be with, and recognizing them in their particularity, and not accepting or organizing your relationships along the logics of what women want. I think this is such a pernicious question, and it's obviously a question that has been around for a very long time. I mean, Freud is bandying it about over 100 years ago. And it almost always leads to a very dissatisfactory answer, and one that just will not apply to many women at any given time, because, you know, turns out women are people and people want different things. And I think trying to let go of those ideas that are cultivated in us from a very young age about men and women being, you know, different, and we're of certain types and kinds, that kind of men are from Mars, women are from Venus type logic that has had such a long, that book has had such a long cultural afterlife. Mm-hmm. And I think really trying to let go of that and trying to focus more on relating to the object of your desire or the person in front of you, just in their unique subjectivity, and just letting go of those ideas about what women want or what men are like. Or I just think that those ideas, if you certainly from the kind of the work I've done and the kind of kaleidoscope of personalities that make up the book, there's just no way, it's always going to be so diminishing to answer that question in a, mm-hmm. you know, what are men like? What do women want? We're more complicated than that. And we know this, but there's such a comfort in these very tired, but simplistic narratives. There's a comfort in that because they're simple, they're easy, right? It's black and white, it's good and bad. And, you know, we often kind of find recourse to those kinds of stories and those kinds of scripts, but we know from our own lived experience that life is not quite so simple. So yeah, so relating to the other person as a subject and recognizing your own subjectivity and kind of subject to subject relationality. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, those were great. That was a great answer. Well, if you have anything else to say, welcome to hear it. But, you know, it's, I think already we've touched on like so many subjects. It's been about an hour, and thank you so much for having this discussion. Also, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
It was great. Do you have any kind of closing thoughts or
I don't have anything else I would add, really. I mean, I would love, you know, if people are interested in this work, obviously I have a book, but I also have lots of articles that are available for you to access. So I would love if people wanted to read and engage.
Yeah, I'll put that in the description also, just to for anybody interested.
Amazing. Thank you.
Great. Yeah, thank you for coming on. All right.
Cheers. Okay. Bye.
All right. Now